Welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Trauma Super Conference. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Dr. Richard Schwartz. He began his career as a systemic family therapist and an academic. Dr. Schwartz discovered that family therapy alone did not achieve full symptom relief. And in asking his patients why, he learned that they were plagued by what they called parts. These patients became his teachers, as they described how their parts formed networks of interrelationship that resembled the families he had been working with. He also found that as they focused on and thereby separated from these parts, they would shift into a state characterized by qualities like curiosity, calm, confidence, and compassion. He called that inner essence the self. From these early explorations, the internal family systems model, or IFS, was born in the early 1980s. IFS is now evidence-based and has become a widely used form of psychotherapy, particularly with trauma. It provides a non-pathologizing, optimistic, and empowering perspective, and a practical and effective set of techniques for working with individuals, couples, families, and more recently, corporations and classrooms. Dr. Richard Schwartz, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Megan. It's a treat to be with you.
So I want to start, we talked about it just briefly in your intro, but I definitely want to ask you, what is the internal family systems methodology and what inspired you to create it?
Maybe I'll take the second part of that question first. So as you mentioned in the intro, this goes back about 40, I think it'll be 40 years next year that I started on this journey. And as you also said in the intro, it was simply listening to my clients at the time talk about why they weren't getting better from straight family therapy. And this was a group of bulimic kids that I was doing an outcome study with, and they started talking this language of parts, and they'd say some version of, if I ever get triggered, this critic starts to attack me inside and call me terrible names, and then that brings up a part that can make me feel totally worthless and alone and lonely and empty. And that feeling is so dreadful that the binge comes in to get me away from it. But then the binge brings back the critic who's calling me a pig on top of the other names. And I'm in this vicious circle for days. And so I was just really interested as a systems thinker, not just about each part, but about how they all interacted as a system inside, and got curious about that. And long story short, learned that none of them are what they seemed, that our field and our culture has really mistaken the part for the role it's in, and thought the critic is just an inner critic who maybe carries some of your parents' energy, but is basically that's all it is. And the binge is an out-of-control impulse. And when you think of them that way, it makes sense to argue with the critic or try to control the binge, which is basically what our culture and psychotherapy has been trying to do for decades. But as I listened to them, I learned that that they really didn't like their roles, and that they would love to get out of those roles if they thought it was safe, but they didn't think it was safe. And as I explored that more, because I initially would fight with them, but then I learned that they weren't what they seemed. So I started getting clients to ask them questions and just get curious about them. And that's when I started learning all this. And in the process learned that they just weren't living in the present either. They were all frozen in traumas, in traumatic times in the clients, often childhood. And to the point where if my client asked how old they thought my client was almost always a single digit, and just were shocked to learn that my client was, most of my clients were in their 20s at that time. So by just staying curious, and I was lucky that I was a family therapist and I didn't have much intrapsychic training. So I came to this with a blank slate. I just had to get curious and not assume things about these parts. And so that was a big advantage. And so just by helping my clients ask these open-ended questions, we learned, as I said, that they aren't what they seem, that they're stuck in these roles they don't like. They're frozen. The role got started back in the trauma time. And they carry what I'm going to call burdens, which are extreme beliefs and emotions that came into them from the trauma and, like a virus, then drive the way they operate. And as I learned all that, I became curious about how can we change all this? How can we use some systems thinking to actually help these parts out of these roles? And as I did that, I would find they would immediately transform into what turns out to be who they're naturally designed to be. So from all that exploration, I started to conclude, and this is a basic assumption of the model. First of all, that we're all multiple personalities in the sense that we all have these parts that, in my mind, we're born with them, either manifest or dormant. And that it's good to have them because they all have valuable qualities and resources to help us in our lives. But they're forced out of those naturally valuable states by trauma, by attachment injuries, by the slings and arrows, into roles they don't like and don't think it's safe to leave because they're frozen in time and they carry these extreme beliefs and emotions. So that's the short version, very short version of IFS. And
Yeah, the
I
short version of
didn't.
40 years of history, right?
Right, I didn't even get to what you introduced as the self yet, so.
Well, yeah, but let's put a pin in it because I want to come back to a couple things that you said, which it occurs to me while you're talking that had you not been dealing with young people and young adults, do you think they would have been as vulnerable and as open about these parts of themselves that were speaking up, right? Because I just imagine adults, they don't want to admit that there's like these multiple personalities in their brains and in their emotions because of the way they think it might sound, especially from a psychological perspective, if they have any knowledge. So, what role do you think that the vulnerability of their age had to do with you kind of learning about this?
I think it had to do with that. And also, there's something about people with eating disorders who know their parts intimately and don't mind talking about them. And I think it's because they stand out in such bold relief in there. Like the critic, is just right in their face constantly. And then they do know about what I call the exile little young part that carries all that worthlessness and so on. And I was lucky that I just had a couple clients who were very articulate about the phenomena. And I think it is in part their age, but also sort of their desperation for help and their acquaintance with these parts because they stand out in such bold relief.
Yeah. And I know you mentioned, obviously, this is a trauma conference and you mentioned trauma, but one of the things that I loved is in your book, you said parts are not the result of trauma, they're the result of being human. So why do we develop these parts and how might it be different from the experience for someone who has experienced trauma as opposed to someone who hasn't experienced trauma?
Yeah, so in my mind, we don't develop them. They come with us into this world. We're born with them. But what develops are the extreme roles they're forced into. So, this is different because most models of trauma that do think about parts or aware of parts see them as fragments of the unitary personality that was blown apart by the trauma. Which for me is a pathologizing view because they're seen as, a product of the explosion of what should be one. And the goal then becomes to get Humpty Dumpty back into one. And so my goal instead is just to help them all be able to transform into their naturally valuable states and also start to get along with each other and then trust what I came to call the self as the leader. Because they're all pretty young, even the ones, the big critics and all the ones who are trying to get you achievements in life and seem so adult-like, they're mainly what I call, in family therapy, we call them parentified children in families. They're kids who had to take on a parental role. And that's true for all these parts. So the goal is for them to realize there's somebody else in there who can actually lead your life in a much healthier way.
And so that brings me to a really good point about kind of the self as you're describing it. And in my notes, I always, write it with a big S self, right? And so the 8 C's that you describe are the characteristics of the self, and how do they relate to the IFS?
Yeah, so as I was trying to get my clients to listen to these parts rather than fight with them, it was challenging because maybe I'd have you listening, trying to get you to listen to your critic, and as you did that, you would suddenly become angry at the critic, and the critic would be defensive in there, and then things would break down. And it reminded me of family sessions where maybe I'm having two family members talk to each other, and one of them, and I'm trying to have them listen to each other, and one of them suddenly gets angry at the other, and we were taught to look around the room and see if somebody else in the room isn't covertly siding with the one who's angry. Often that found that person and got them out of their eye view in the room, improved the boundary around the original two, and they settled down and had a good conversation. And it occurred to me maybe the same thing's happening in this inner system. As I'm having you talk to your critic, maybe a part that hates the critic has jumped in. So I began asking, I would ask you, could you see if that one who hates the critic could just relax for a little while longer so we can just get to know the critic more? Maybe pull its energy out for a second. And to my amazement, clients could do that. And when they did it, suddenly they would shift from, I hate you, to, I'm just kind of interested in why you call me names all day. Curious, calm, confident, even compassionate. And in that state, the critic would relax and would share its secret history of how it got forced into that role in some trauma. And my client would even open their heart even more to it. And we could actually extend an even appreciation for trying to keep my client safe, even if it's tearing her down. And thinking, if it doesn't tear her down and she takes risks, she's going to get hurt again, so I better do that. So that's just one example of the common positive intentions that these parts have. And so we could extend that appreciation to your critic, and it would relax. And then we could even negotiate permission to go to what it protects in there, which would be one of these, usually one of these very vulnerable inner children parts that got hurt or terrified or shamed and is still stuck back there. And there's a process by which we could get it out of there and help it unburden, and it would also turn into a happy little inner kid. So, and then the critic could see, well, I guess I don't have to do this job anymore, and would transfer itself. So, but back to the self, as I was trying that with other clients, just getting some of the extreme parts to open space inside, it was like the same person popped out with the same C-word qualities of calm, curiosity, confidence, compassion, and then others like clarity, courage, creativity, and connectedness. And so at some point, I concluded that that's in everybody, can't be damaged, and is just beneath the surface of these parts, such that when they open space, it does emerge spontaneously and it knows how to heal, both in the inner world and in the outer world. And that's a big deal. That's the big deal about IFS, that's easy to access in most people quickly. You can get into that, some degree of that state. And then in that state, they can begin to heal themselves. So that we called, I call it self because when I get you there, I might say, Megan, what part of you is that? You'd likely answer, that's not exactly like these other parts. That's more me or myself. So that's why I call it the self. And capitalize the S just to distinguish it from the ordinary use of the word self.
And I love, the process of it. And I can hear, and I encourage anybody who picks up your book to also listen to the audiobook, because listening to you kind of go through these exercises with people is fantastic and adds something. I think that just you can read it, but when you're hearing you go through it, it's really instrumental to understanding kind of the process. But just this process, especially for people who have experienced trauma, of first understanding we all have parts, right? And then the permission, the permissive aspect of like, okay, who needs to speak up, and can I have your permission to either step aside so I can talk to a different aspect of this person, or step aside because I can only deal with one of you at a time. Like kind of like I imagine like a toddler teacher, like a nursery school teacher, right? Like, okay, I can only deal with one person at a time. I will get to you, I promise. Which is this kind of asking permission and just honoring the protective nature, right? Just how much what's true about you and all those wonderful qualities. And I don't know if anybody who's watching can relate to that, but curiosity and calm and creativity and connectedness, those are all the things that dwindle in me when I am in some sort of activation or trigger, or I'm having difficulty, I'm living kind of in history and not in the present, right? Those are the first things to go, and they're the first things that make me feel most like myself, right? And I think a lot of people can relate to that. And so having a process that you can go through where you're going to understand, get permission, talk through, and then unburden, as you call it, that part from the job it's taken on instead of the job it was meant to do, is just beautiful. I just want a golf
Thank you.
class.
Yeah, I
That's not a
won't argue with
question, more
you.
like a
It's
reflection, but yeah.
yeah, no, it's beautiful every time I do it with somebody. It is. Yeah.
So, with unhealed trauma, can you take me kind of through? We've talked about parts, but you also have names for these parts, right? And kind of the high level view. Take me through kind of the main labels of these parts and how they show up in trauma as kind of parts, exiles, and their burdens.
Yeah, as I'm learning about all these parts inside of clients, I'm a bit overwhelmed. But as a systems person, I thought I'll just do what I do in families, where we would map the different patterns in the family. And so I started to look for distinctions among the parts, and the main distinction that leaped out immediately was between parts that were very vulnerable and turned out before they were hurt or terrified or shamed, we would call them these delightful inner children who could lend us all kinds of joy and curiosity about the world and innocence and creativity and so on. But once they get hurt, and they're the ones that get hurt the most because they're the most vulnerable, they now take in those burdens of worthlessness or terror or emotional pain and so on. And now they have the power to overwhelm us with those feelings and make us feel all that we swore we'd never feel again. And so we almost naturally, and everybody around us tells us to just lock all that up inside. And so when we succeed, then those young parts who just by dint of getting hurt become what I call exiles. So for them, it's insult to injury. The injury was the trauma, and now the insult is being abandoned by you. And you don't even know you're doing it because you think you're just moving on from the memories or the emotions of the trauma, not realizing you're locking away your juice, your most precious qualities, just because they got hurt. So those I came to call exiles. And when you have a lot of exiles, you feel a lot more delicate. The world seems a lot more dangerous. So because so many things could trigger them, and when they get triggered, it's like an explosion of flames of emotion that consume you and take you back into those scenes and so on. So to deal with that, to keep those exiles contained and not triggered and not hurt, there's a bunch of parts that leave their naturally valuable states and enter the protector role. And there are two classes of those. So some become preemptive protectors who are trying to manage your life so that nothing triggers those exiles. So they make sure you don't get too close to anybody, or they make sure you look great all the time so nobody rejects you, or they make you achieve a lot so that you get a lot of accolades to counter the worthlessness, or maybe they make you take care of everybody so they depend on you and never let you take care of yourself, of course. Or they become these inner critics who are just trying to get you to do better, try harder, look better, or trying to tear down your confidence so you don't take risks, and so on and so on. There's a lot of different common manager roles. These are what we call manager protectors, because they're, again, they manage your body so that you don't feel too much. They can numb you out or take you out, keep you a little bit separate from your body, keep you in your head. Sometimes they're these intellectual thinking protectors. So anyway, there's a lot of those, and despite their best efforts, the world has still a way of triggering your exiles, and when that happens, it's a big emergency because it's these flames of emotion. So there's another set of parts who immediately go into action to deal with that emergency, and they'll do it either by dousing the flames with some substance or getting you higher than the flames until they burn themselves out, or distracting you until they burn themselves out. And so we call those firefighters. They're fighting the fire of exile pain. And most all of us have a kind of hierarchy of them. So if the first one doesn't work, we go to the next and so on. And so in contrast to the managers who are trying to keep you in control and please people usually, these firefighters are very impulsive. They don't care about the collateral damage to your relationships or your body. They just got to get you away from that fire or you're going to die. That's their belief often. And so a lot of the addictions are about that. A lot of dissociating, the sort of immediate dissociation kinds of reactions, and so on and so on. So suicide is the top of the hierarchy for most people. It's just, you know, if it gets too hot, there's this escape route. So we call them firefighters. And so the map is very simple. There are protectors, one class of which is managers, the other class is firefighters. They're both doing their best to contain and protect the exiles. And they often polarize with each other because, like I said, the managers want to keep you in control, the firefighters take you out of control. So that's the map. And it's held up really well these 40 years.
Yeah, and I think it also really helps explain to people who either suffer high anxiety from a result of, you know, experience with trauma, or they have high levels of trauma, how they can be so high functioning, right? That's how it kind of all made sense to me. I was like, oh, they've just got excellent managers.
That's right.
And then when you hit a tipping point where those managers are overburdened, then a firefighter comes in with either substance or, you know, outside distractions. Those can be people, right? Like you get into a tumultuous love affair or something like that. It can be a new job as a distraction. It can be all kinds of things that you're going to go towards that aren't really going to serve your capital S self, but you're using to kind of distract yourself or, get yourself away from that discomfort.
Yeah, well said.
And one of the things that I really resonated with that you said in the book is that when you listen to your parts and your body, your exiles don't have to use your body to get your attention.
Yeah, that's an aspect we haven't mentioned yet, but many, many physical symptoms are the product of you're not listening to your exiles. And if you don't listen to them, they'll find whatever they got. They haven't got that many ways to try to get your attention. But they do know about whatever genetic predispositions you have for different diseases, and they know how to give you pain, physical pain, and so on, and they'll do that. And then medicine is designed to kill the messenger rather than listen to the message, as is psychiatry. So there's a lot of killing of these messengers happening rather than listening to the message and trying to help the part.
Right. And I have, a ton of sympathy for people who go with those modes of treatment. They're often the quickest. They're often the easiest to incorporate into your life, right? So I have a ton of empathy and sympathy for that matter, for people that go that route. At a certain point, though, there is kind of a law of diminishing returns, and you've got to get a little bit more curious and kind of dig a little deeper to find the source of the exacerbation of your inflammation or depression or mental health issues or just actual, digestion, all kinds of ways that it can show up in your body if you're not treating the underlying factors, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And I don't mean to imply that all medical symptoms are the product of parts, because that's not true. But you'd be surprised at how many are. Or the reaction against or the fear of the symptom is parts you can deal with too.
Absolutely. One of the ways that I was really validated in your work as well was in the way that you talked about kind of the traps of meditation and spiritual bypassing. And obviously we're in kind of a self-development circle here with Trauma Conference. We have lots of breath work and meditation and things like that. So I'm not in any way trying to take away from the benefits of those methodologies. However, in talking about a parts work framework, how do people sometimes use spirituality or meditation or things like that to kind of bypass what we're talking about? It's yet another coping mechanism, yeah?
Yeah, so many of those practices and polyvagal stuff and all of that can be useful in terms of accessing what I call self sometimes, and meditation as well, and are used to quote unquote regulate your system. But by that, it often means it's a way to either get away from or calm down your exiles, which is needed so you can function a lot of the time, but it doesn't heal them. It doesn't really do much for them other than placate them. And that's true for mindfulness too. And so that's at best, and at worst, a lot of those practices can be used to bypass and really stay away from, as far as possible, the exiles. I actually, at this conference I mentioned, just had a debate with Marianne Williamson about this, because she's all about, go to the light, don't go to the darkness. And that message just keeps a lot of parts exiled, I think. And the light, you can feel really good in the light. And you can function better. I did TM as a kid, and it was very helpful to me. I was much more focused, and I could operate better in the world, and I really thought this was it. But it didn't heal any of my parts. It didn't heal my exiles. It just helped me stay above them. So my message is, yeah, meditate, do that, but don't do it as a way to stay away from this stuff. Do it as a way to bring that state, that self state, to the pain or the shame or the terror, and help it heal, rather than do it as a way to stay away from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And as somebody who has been practicing meditation off and on for 20 years, but didn't start trauma work until 5 or 6 years ago, I can attest that a lot of people with trauma find it really difficult to do mindfulness and meditation exercises because the minute you quiet down, a lot of parts get really loud. And so I
That's
just
right.
want to really
That's right.
validate people's experiences. And it doesn't mean that there's not a ton of usefulness. And all the science backs it up. But if you're not incorporating something like parts work into it, then that can be a really scary proposition. And then, you feel twice as bad because you've got trauma and you also can't meditate, right? Like, so let's find other methods to incorporate that, get curious, get safe, get permission, listen and learn.
Yeah, I do. I just want to reiterate that there's a lot of value in a lot of that, as long as it's not being used to keep away from the parts that need your love.
Yeah, and some of the traditional methodologies or spiritual traditions, you know, just don't incorporate this stuff yet. I think we're coming into an age where they're going to start. And that is being acknowledged in a lot of spiritual traditions, this kind of idea of the self and the, you know, even the ego not being something we need to get rid of, but something we need to make healthy. Traditionally, especially anybody of a certain age, that certainly wasn't the case 20 or 40 years ago.
No, I mean, and there is this attitude that spiritual traditions have about the ego. And so I'm a big champion of the ego as just a cluster of little protectors trying their best to keep you alive and safe and not something to be dissolved or demeaned, but in fact, something to be honored and appreciated and then helped, like you said, out of the pressured role it has to try and run your whole life is because it's a bunch of little kids who are trying their best.
Absolutely. I love that visual. Just a bunch of little kids trying their best, right? Let's give them a mentor, somebody to keep them safe.
Exactly right. That's right.
And that actually kind of leads into my next question, which is about the self, right? So you emphasize in the book that the point of all of this, you know, getting to know your managers, your exiles, your firefighters, and giving them different jobs is so that you can communicate with them that the self, your big self, big S self, with all of this curiosity and creativity and calm is going to take care of them and that they can trust the self, right?
Can you say
a little bit about that?
Yeah. So when you were hurt as a kid, that's when these parts jumped into these roles and then they stay in those roles the rest of your life. And they don't even know about you as a self, what I'm calling yourself. They just think, I mean, they're literally frozen back there. They live as if the world is still as dangerous now as it was back then. And there isn't anybody. Because when you're a kid, you didn't have the brain or the body to actually protect yourself. So they're stuck back in those scenes, and then and so there are four main goals of IFS. One is, I've already talked about, the transformation of these parts to liberate them from the roles they're stuck in so they can be where they're designed to be. But the second one is exactly what you're talking about, which is to help restore the trust they lost back when self couldn't protect the system in self, help them get to know there is this other person in there who isn't 5 years old and can actually lead the system in a healthy way. And sometimes that takes quite a bit of work because they really don't believe in self, or they, where were you when I needed you kind of message. And then the third goal is then, and with often with self as a leader, to help these parts get to know each other and harmonize with each other and stop being so polarized and get the whole team to work together with self as a leader. And then the fourth goal is to become what we call more self-led in the outside world, so that you, in your relationships with other people, you speak from these C-word qualities you also start to be more of a social activist, usually people do, or to just deal with what they see in their lives as in inequities and injustices, and because self has courage and clarity and confidence. And so, you know, it's all part of a grand scheme of mine to bring more self to the world and to try to, and this being election day, it's very meaningful that the world really needs it. And so those are the goals of IFS. And and as you were saying, this idea of getting the parts to trust and know this inner leader so they can relax more and become advisors rather than, you know, the bus drivers, that's a big part of this.
It's interesting you say that because I'm reminded of, I have elementary school children who are shifting into those middle years. And one of the things that I've gotten advice on recently from from parents of older children is that I'm now moving into a consultant role, right? I'm not the manager of their behavior and learning. I'm moving into more of a consultant, see? And so if these parts are trapped in their kind of childhood roles and defenses, it makes sense that you would, in making them safe, you're like, okay, but I'm moving into more of a consultant role. And I just want to acknowledge also that something that I hadn't brought up yet that you reminded me of is just that this book isn't just about making you secure in yourself. It's also because when we all do this work, we're with the interconnectedness of all of us in our big ass selves is really evident, and you're not able to ignore it anymore, right?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. You become much more aware of how other people in this country or people around the world are suffering, then it's going to affect you in some way. So that C word connectedness is a kind of intuitive feeling that you have that you can't just take care of your little circle, but you have to extend your compassion. And the good news is that what we call self-energy is contagious. So even in the middle of a crisis of some kind, if I can be in self, that will pull for the selves of everybody else. And then you have a very different experience of whatever the crisis is.
You led me perfectly into my next question, which is around, you know, I know that there's many books about IFS and guides, and there's even a little card deck that I own. I think I've got it right here, a little interactive card deck that I love. But one of the things that I appreciated most is how you emphasize that you should find a guide or a support person who can stay in self, big ass self, for themselves while you're having emotions. And so why is that? And why is that guidance so important?
Yeah. So that guide ideally would be a trained IFS therapist. And part of the training is helping the therapist get to know their parts and in particular get to know the parts of them that might be triggered by parts of their clients. Because if I'm with you and you go to one of your exiles and you're very emotional and sad and crying and I don't have a good relationship with my own exiles, then I'm going to try and cheer you up right away or distract you out of that, even unconsciously. It's going to be very hard for me to stay present with you while you're in that level of emotion. Or if suddenly you're angry at me, and I have a lot of fear of my own anger or my own critic or any of that, then I'm going to dissociate somehow or something. So the point being that how you relate to your own parts will have a big impact on how you can be with people when they resemble your parts. And if you can be in self, even when somebody's in some extreme part, they feel that safety. They feel that they're not alone in it. They feel witnessed and cared about. In a way they don't if you get triggered too. So
absolutely. And I think we've all had experiences of that, of both on the receiving end of, I feel like that person hasn't witnessed me and is really missing me and has gone somewhere, even if they're right in front of us, they've gone off somewhere. They're not here anymore. Or they're shooting me out of what I'm experiencing. They're giving me phrases
intellectual and interpreting it. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Instead of just being able to witness and being in their real self. And also, I'm sure everybody can also imagine and remember moments where they've done that to someone else because they were uncomfortable and their parts were relating to what the other person was experiencing. And so they had to dissociate or shame or shut down or just really miss what the person was saying. So it really helps us just more deeply relate to other people when they're experiencing things.
Yeah. I mean, I've apologized many times to my kids because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And my parts were pretty extreme back in those days.
So. Yes. Well, that's, I think, the most important lesson of parenting, right? Is learning how to apologize, really.
Totally.
Everybody expects people to, especially on the self-development path, to be perfect parents. And I'm like, ooh, no. I just know how to apologize really well.
It's It's a good one for marriage too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, any relationship as it was. Well, I want to be respectful of your time. I could talk to you forever, but if people want to know more about you, about IFS, how to find IFS support, how can they do that?
Well, the website is ifs-institute.com, and on it they'll find we do run a lot of training programs. Unfortunately or fortunately, they're very, very popular now, so they're hard to get into. And in the meantime, we have a program called the Online Circle Program, where people get most of the content. And then there are lots of books and other kinds of resources. Yes, and
Your
that book
book.
is a good starter.
It is.
I want to mention also we have a there's an IFS. It's called the Foundation for Self-Leadership. If anybody wants to donate, we do. I don't, but the foundation does research and a lot of other things, so people can check that out too.
Fantastic. Dick Schwartz, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Megan. It's a treat to get to know you.
Thank you.